This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. In the annals of economic theory, you've got your lagging indicators, your leading indicators, and then you've got Jay the Butcher.
I think people are not going to restaurants more. They're cooking home more. I actually think that the food business has gained as opposed to lost because of people cutting back on the evenings out and stuff like that. I see a lot more people here than before.
Driving an economy with no windshield, no crystal balls, and rearview mirrors, the challenge of gauging a recession when some statistics look forward and others look backward. Dancing in the dark with the present moment, economically speaking, on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Wednesday, July 15th. I'm John Hockenberry, a total laggard here on a Wednesday with the perpetually perky and leading Farai Chidea. Good morning, Farai.
Hey, John, you're underrating yourself.
Well, thank you very much. We are puzzling through the twisted world of word of mouth in the Hollywood age of Twitter. Hollywood is really up in arms about this. Movies out today. The Harry Potter movie is one of them. Passing the torch to young leaders at the NAACP convention. That's coming up. They're celebrating 100 years. But let's look back at what Jay the Butcher had to say. Lakshman Achuthan is the managing director of Economic Cycles Research Institute. It's a market analysis company. So, Lakshman, is Jay the Butcher a leading indicator in the economy, or is he a lagging indicator?
I think he's much more coincident. And what we heard just there was, kind of what we've all seen, which is that it's expensive to go out, so we're going to stay home and eat. And this is the so-called value proposition. That's how corporations look at it, hopefully, is that when times are tough, we're all looking for a good deal. We're nesting. And you're seeing all kinds of activities around the home do quite a bit better during tough times.
Well, we're going to continue this conversation. The challenge of looking ahead or looking behind and knowing which statistics you're looking at any given moment in the economy. Which are you, by the way? Are you a snapshot of the future or the past in the economy? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Everything you need to know this morning in the headlines. Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor starts day three of her Senate confirmation hearings later on this morning. President Obama takes to the Rose Garden to push health care reform. The House has a $1.5 trillion bill on the table, moves to the Senate, and more than 160 people are feared dead in a plane crash in Iran. A Caspian Airlines flight from Tehran went down in the nation's northwest.
And al-Qaeda's number two man tells Pakistanis to join the fight against the U.S. Ayman al-Zawahiri has a new audio message out. He's criticizing the Pakistani offensive against militants in the northwest. And the tsunami warning in the Pacific has been downgraded. A warning center says the tsunami generated after a 7.8 magnitude quake off of the New Zealand coast is, quote, small and poses no threat.
So Wall Street had a bump up yesterday. What will happen today? The Dow starts trading at 8359. The S&P begins at 905. And the NASDAQ kicks off at 1799. Those are economic indicators. What about this one?
Historically, even after you start moving into a recovery, positive growth, hiring typically lags.
Lagging indicators, leading indicators, are you a snapshot of the future or of the past in your own economic experience in this recession? Call us with your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Boy, they had a great present moment over at Goldman Sachs yesterday, wouldn't you say?
Yes, present as in wrapped up in a bow.
Right. Farai Chidea is with me, and we're talking about Goldman Sachs' present moment. They did $3.44 billion of business in the latest quarter. Is that an indication of future good tidings for the bank? Is it a leading indicator or is it a lagging indicator that Goldman did some great stuff and the future of the economy is anybody's bet? That's really the story this morning, and it's what we're talking about, leading and lagging economic indicators. It makes all the difference whether you're looking ahead or looking behind, and what numbers you're looking at determine whether you're facing the rearview mirror or looking clearly through the windshield at what's ahead in the economy. Continuing now with Lakshman Ashutan, who's managing director of ECRI, Economic Cycles Research Institute, a market analysis company that forecasts recessions and recoveries. Lakshman, thanks so much for being here.
Sure.
And, you know, what kinds of statistics that we report on every month look forward and what ones look behind? The president seems to think that employment indicators are always lagging indicators. Is that your view?
Yeah, they're roughly coincident to lagging. It depends what you're looking at. The unemployment rate is lagging. Headline payroll jobs, like how many you lost or how many you gained each month, that's roughly coincident. You can't have an end to the recession unless you actually get some jobs growth.
Right.
Okay, so we're going to have to see that. But we recently had a monthly jobs report that came in weaker than expected, and all of a sudden all the green shoots that were out there died, right? And everybody said – and the stock market stopped going up, and it used to be on a tear. And so everybody said, well, you know, this recession's with us. It's not going away at all. And that is a lot of rear view or side window looking. You're not looking out the windshield in front of you.
And it's losing the signal for the noise of the numbers day to day. And that's really the challenge.
Absolutely.
Here.
The consensus, there's a widespread inability to distinguish among leading, coincident, and lagging indicators. And also, there's an overweight attention put on anything that is new. Because basically, like 99% of the news out there is not leading, okay?
And right.
But it's new. But it's new.
But
news,
it is new.
Right?
I see.
And so, just because it's new, which is the jobs in June were weak, or Intel last quarter did a little bit better, that's seen as somewhat forward-looking. Has nothing to do with the future.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your forecast that was reported on this program yesterday by Dan Gross of Newsweek, who said you have the best look forward of anybody because you've been doing it for longer than anyone and taking data that goes way, way, way back.
Right.
You think that the recession is going to end when, and when are we going to feel it?
Okay, those are two different times, okay? By April, looking at these leading indicators, and, you know, look, to be fair, this is not something I came up with. I'm standing on the shoulders of giants from a couple of generations before me, going back to the booms and busts that occurred before the Great Depression. And there's a sequence of events of leading indicators and then coincident indicators that have remained durable all that time. And those began rising very convincingly at the beginning of the year. By April, it was clear the recession would be over this summer. I don't think the man in the street will feel that until the fall when they're looking in the rearview mirror, because really your gut feel is a rearview mirror feel.
What about sub-demographics? You know, you have America at large, but you also have, you know, teens who are, you know, 18, 19 who have to work. You have recent college graduates, people of color, et cetera. Do you have any idea how any of those groups might be affected by this, you know, emerging recovery, hopefully?
There's going to be some echoes of what we saw in the last recovery. If you recall, following the 2001 recovery, it was a jobless recovery. It was tough, and I suspect this time around we're going to have echoes of that. If you're exposed to the manufacturing sector, it's not going to feel good anytime soon, even though technically the recession is going to end. If you're a man or a minority, you'll probably have a little bit tougher go because so many of these kind of hands-on construction, manufacturing type industries are really going to hurt for a while. Women may do a little bit better.
Here's what one African-American man had to say about this lagging indicator.
The hard truth is that some of the jobs that have been lost in the auto industry and elsewhere won't be coming back.
So permanent job losses, that's something we do have to focus on.
He's spot on right there because
President Obama.
Speaking
I don't see any axle grease under his finger.
No, not at all.
Well, you know, here's the cold hard facts. Over the last 10 years, 10 years ago we had 18 million manufacturing jobs. Today we have 12 million. We've lost a third of them. They're never coming back. That type of experience is probably repeating right now into the recovery.
All right, well, we're going to hear voices of people having that experience and talk a little more about this in just a moment. But, of course, lots more news, and we shift down to Washington. Farai?
Thanks, John. And it is day three of Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor's Senate confirmation hearings. And joining us once again is Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. He's been at the hearings on Capitol Hill. Morning.
Morning, Farai.
So Sotomayor's wise Latina comment has drawn lots of attention. So how did the Republicans quiz her about it? How did she respond?
She had to respond to the wise Latina remark, but not just the remark, but the remark in context, the suggestion that not just that you need more women and minorities on the bench, but that they would somehow rule in a way that's better than all of the old white guys that are on the bench. She had to answer questions about the Second Amendment, about abortion, but the wise Latina remark really did get a lot of attention. I have a cut here from Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. He went right at the nominee. Listen to this.
Do you understand, ma'am, that if I had said anything like that, and my reasoning was that I'm trying to inspire somebody, they would have had my head. Do you understand that?
Almost a lecture. I mean, he almost lectured her that if he is a white guy had said that.
Poor white guy. Yeah.
Well, Lindsey Graham has said things like this before, but he went right at her and made her answer. Do you understand what I'm saying? Are you feeling me? And she had a response.
The words I chose, taking the rhetorical flourish, is a bad idea. I do understand that. There are some who have read this differently, and I understand why they might have concern, but I have repeated more than once, and I will repeat throughout, if you look at my history on the bench, you will know that I do not believe that any ethnic, gender, or race group has an advantage in sound judging.
And, you know, Todd, although she said that, there have been hints, even from President Obama, that he believes that people who've had hard life experiences or who've, you know, overcome their backgrounds may have a sense of empathy that is greater. And so Senator John Kyle from Arizona asked Sotomayor whether or not she agreed with President Obama's statements on empathy. So what happened there?
Well, empathy has been what wise Latina has been one of the buzzwords of this of these proceedings, and empathy has been one of the other ones. And you're right. The president has said that the law gets you most of the way when you're a judge. The law is very clear. You rule according to the law. And there's part of it. He uses a marathon metaphor. There's a little part of it that's about your experiences and your empathy for the litigants. And that drives Republicans crazy. It drives John Kyle crazy. Listen to what he said to the nominee on the empathy question.
Do you agree with him that the law only takes you the first 25 miles of the marathon and that last mile has to be decided by what's in the judge's heart?
No, sir. I wouldn't approach the issue of judging in the way the president does. He has to explain what he meant by judging. I can only explain what I think judges should do, which is judges can't rely on what's in their heart. They don't determine the law. Congress makes the laws. The job of a judge is to apply the law.
All right, so John Kyle, that was meant to placate Republicans like John Kyle. And then they're keeping score and sort of giving a sense of where they might be going today when there's more questioning today and possibly tomorrow. We met with John Kyle, a couple of reporters afterward, to find out what he thought about her answer. She doesn't agree with the president. She agrees with Kyle.
It would be an argument to vote for her that she has disagreed with the president and agreed with me on the proper standard for judging. So I count that as a check mark on the plus side. I take it as a check mark on the sort of plus side that she acknowledged her word choice was poor. But I think that it was far more than word choice. I think she had a point to make in those speeches. She made it. She made it at least three times. She wrote a law review article about it. It's not something that she didn't give a lot of consideration to.
Oh, this is such a moronic argument, it seems. Kyle knows exactly what she said. She wasn't saying that Hispanic women are better than anybody else. I think this is ridiculous. The senators are embarrassing me.
John, there was some interesting back and forth on that issue, because especially when – if you go back, actually, I don't know how much of Kyle's question period you got to consume yesterday, but it actually is pretty interesting because they go through it – he goes through it in a pretty specific way and makes a pretty strong case that she was saying that those rulings by a Latina woman would be better, not different, but better.
Right.
And she said it more than once. So they want to get to the bottom of it. As annoying as it is, they did make – they're all lawyers, man. They're all prosecutors. They made
all right.
a decent case.
Well, Todd, we look forward to more of your reports, and you're covering the hearings live on Twitter for The Takeaway, or, you know, go to thetakeaway.org. Thanks, Todd.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
We go now to the bedroom of Hannah Tager in Brooklyn, New York. Hannah, you've seen the Harry Potter movie, right?
Yes, yes, I have.
First of all, what's your review?
It was a great movie. I really enjoyed it. I think it's one of the best of the Harry Potter films.
How many friends do you think you will tell that the movie was really great in your view?
Well, I mean, everyone that I see, it was definitely a highlight of this week.
So you'll be texting your friends. All of your friends will be texting their friends all day today, right?
Probably, yeah.
I mean, that's hundreds and hundreds of texts saying, go see this movie, right?
Maybe, yeah.
Now, do you pay attention to something called word of mouth when you go to the movies?
Yeah, I always take advice from my friends about a movie because they usually like what I like. So that's always good to take a recommendation.
So word of mouth is pretty good on this Harry Potter movie, wouldn't you say?
Yes, definitely.
From the mouth of 11-year-old Hannah Tager in Brooklyn.
Marketing expert, social networker. You know, it's funny that everybody can be a marketer using Facebook, Twitter, email. And Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince opened at 12:01 this morning. It got some early devotees. The word of mouth on this multi-million dollar picture and other ones like it is being shaped by Hannah. People like her at 11, you know, folks of all ages who've got mobile cell phones. We've got Sharon Waxman with us, editor-in-chief of the entertainment news site, TheWrap.com. Sharon, you've got movies like Sacha Baron Cohen's Bruno, Harry Potter. Here's a tweet about Harry Potter. Had an amazing time watching Harry Potter, even though all the teens cracking up at pervertedness. It has a little hashtag FB, which means it's cross-posted to Facebook. Somebody else then says, just slept through half of Harry Potter, so ready to be in bed asleep. Sharon, what's the impact of having a film out for just hours and then having it Twittered immediately?
That's pretty interesting. I love that evidence on the ground you're giving us here. Well, I think this is one of the phenomena that we're seeing this summer that we haven't really seen before, and Hollywood's kind of trying to figure it out as they're trying to figure out a whole lot of things that are going on in the digital world all the time. But basically, word of mouth is kind of being hypercharged by things like Twitter. We've already had a phenomena over the past year, two, or you know, something like that, when word of mouth kind of flies out of the theater, because you actually have young people particularly texting their reactions to movies while they're sitting in the theater. So this is absolutely confounding the people who spend millions and millions of dollars marketing their movies and putting television trailers on and billboards and shaping the message for that really critical opening weekend. Usually all of that money that they spend goes to kind of getting that big number. You know, for years now, we've been having this box office sweepstakes, right, every weekend. Who is number one in the box office? Who's number one in the box office? Well, now, pretty much, that's only really helping you on the first day, is what they're discovering this summer particularly, because word of mouth flies so fast and grows so exponentially because of Twitter particularly, that it's just – that they can't control the message for three whole days. Now it's basically one day, because as soon as the movie, they take the right. veil comes off the movie, they're toast, basically, if it's not good. But it really helps them if it is good. So yeah. either it's really good news or it's really bad news.
Well, you know, you have an article on your site that says, starts out, everything is getting out of Harry Potter's way. And that's in part because it's this enormous franchise. And let's take a listen to a little bit of the character Dumbledore talking to Harry in The Half-Blood Prince.
What you are looking at are memories. In this case, pertaining to one individual, Voldemort. Or as it was known then, Tom Riddle. This file contains the most particular memory of the day I first met him. I'd like you to see it, if you would.
So that rich, plummy, award-winning acting has gotten the franchise very far. But then there's another movie that has also been making a lot of headlines. It's Bruno by Sacha Baron Cohen. It came out on Friday, drawing in millions of dollars. But then it was panned on Twitter, and the ticket sales plummeted by 40% on Saturday. Let's take a listen to Bruno.
Is your baby comfortable with bees, wasps, and hornets?
George is comfortable with everything, so he's fine.
Is he comfortable with dead or dying animals?
Yes.
Is your baby fine with lit phosphorus?
Yes.
Excellent. Does he like it?
Loves it.
Oh, God.
So what went wrong with the whole social marketing aspect, aside from, you know, theoretically endangering small children? You know, what went wrong with the sort of social marketing aspect with Bruno?
Well, we got to look at Twitter, particularly for a certain age demographic. You know, it's interesting that you were reading over the air some of the tweets about Harry Potter, because 11-year-olds are not the big Twitterers. So it's interesting that Harry Potter is also being subject to this Twitter effect. The funny thing is that we wrote about this Twitter effect on the Friday before Bruno, not knowing whether Bruno was going to be an example of that or not, because we've already seen this happen with movies like Up, or with movies like Up in a good way, that tweeting about it helped the movie more, kind of boosted it through the weekend, and then other movies like, say, Land of the Lost or Year One on the downside that got hurt more faster because of tweeting. So we didn't know what was going to happen with Bruno. We wrote it in advance. It was really interesting to see that the movie fell off so fast, and then you could just relate it directly to Twitter, because remember, texting hits one person. If you're a Twitterer and you've got 1,000 people or 500 people following you, that's one right. message that is, you know, being blasted out to a lot of people, and so on and so on and so on.
Well, Sharon,
and Bruno was like number two on the Twitter, you know, most popular tweeted subject.
Well, Sharon, we're going to have to leave it there. That's plenty of information. Sharon Waxman, editor-in-chief of TheWrap.com. Thank you. And now to Femi Okay with the headlines.
Thank you very much. 28 minutes past the hour, the Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor goes before the Senate Judiciary Committee today for another day of questioning. After this session is finished, the committee heads into a closed-door session. Lawmakers in Illinois are expected to vote today on increased regulations for graveyards. This comes after employees at a Chicago-area cemetery apparently dug up at least 300 bodies so that cemetery plots could be resold. It's been almost a month since the deadly train crash on the Washington, D.C. subway, but federal transit investigators say that equipment that's intended to prevent similar wrecks still isn't fully working. Federal investigators are trying to work out why they're still having problems. And in international news, the International Maritime Bureau says that pirate attacks worldwide have more than doubled in the first half of this year compared with the same period a year ago. There were 240 attacks between January and June. Let's look at your news headlines for now.
There's a growing business, piracy. Look at the economy. Future or past? Are you an indicator of what's going to happen or what has happened? Real voices on the economy's future and past coming up.
The
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
More numbers this morning. I'm John Hockenberry. Markets are reacting to the Consumer Price Index, which is down in a year-over-year number, but up in the latest month, but about what analysts were expecting, including a manufacturing index, a key manufacturing index, which is down. Markets reacting. Looks like when Wall Street opens, it will be a positive opening. We've been talking this morning about the difference between measuring the economy and feeling the economy in a time of recession. Lakshman Ashutan is a managing director of Economic Cycles Research Institute. We've been talking with him about all of this, but we also want to welcome two other voices behind the numbers. Jack Bernstein is a caterer and sandwich shop owner in Miami. Ed Snively, who's a real estate broker in El Centro, California. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Nice to be back on.
All right, Ed, let's talk first of all. What are you seeing in this recession, and do you believe, or do you have a position on this, that you're seeing the future of the economy in your experience, or looking really in the rearview mirror?
I think we are seeing positive things in our area. We are seeing, number one, buyers are back in the market. They're taking advantage of great low interest rates, good selection, low prices on homes, federal incentives, state incentives on taxes, builder incentives, and our resale owners are also offering incentives, and that's really driving our market. Our sales are on pace now for a record year.
Wow. Jack Bernstein, as a caterer and sandwich shop owner in Miami, what trends are you seeing, and do you think you're looking forward or looking back?
Well, I personally always look forward because you never like the view looking backwards.
Yeah.
But I think like anything else, I think having good basic business principles, you're always going to have ups and downs. You know, this economy, there's no question, you know, has affected us. My corporate clients are off, you know, well, one of them is off 44%. And part of that is not, you know, they just stopped feeding as many people in their office than they used to. And I just think that, you know, it's right now it's just a current sign of the times. But everybody knows they have to get to work. They got to pay their mortgages or buy new homes, if you will, and do whatever they got to do. And those are great opportunities. So,
all right, well, Jack, it sounds to me like what you're saying is the company that's your main client or one of your main clients had some business setbacks, and that resulted in them cutting back on your contract, and so you're feeling that. So in a sense, you're kind of lagging behind what went on with your clients maybe some months ago, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the good news is for me as a company, or you know, we're about 3% over last year currently.
Wow.
But after doing my analysis, really what has happened, like anything else, is, and my point was, is that as long as you're out selling and you're procuring new clients and new business, it just kind of takes care of its own. So when, yes, when the times get better, these customers, as an example, you used to order once a week, are now, you know, we'll go, you know, are now doing like once a month.
All right, so we got Jack Bernstein, caterer and sandwich shop owner in Miami. That's data point number one. We've got Ed Snively, real estate broker in El Centro, California. That's data point number two. Lakshman Ashutan, how do you take the tone of the voice, what they're saying literally, and the feeling that they're conveying, and convert that into useful economic data?
Well, In terms of what I've just heard between the caterer and the real estate experience, the real estate's a little bit of a leading indicator. Home activity around the house and the housing industry, that is a driver of the business cycle. So what I'm hearing from Ed there is consistent with what we're seeing from other longer leading indicators of the economy, that things have bottomed and begun to improve. And in both cases, what I'm hearing anecdotally is that they've adjusted the businesses as they were sectors have adjusted to the new kind of slower economy. They're both having products that are attractive in this newer, slower economy. I'm sure the caterer
is responding either in terms of incentives in the real estate sector or offering discounts in the catering sector.
Value propositions, however that manifests itself. The caterer is adjusting to maybe less frequent catering or giving some other kind of value to his customers in order to have them grow 3%. On the real estate side, basically what he's describing is that housing affordability has skyrocketed. And all that means is that prices have plunged, which we've all heard a lot about. Interest rates are low. And if you have a job, then this is a very attractive time to go out and get a house. And I had talked earlier about the massive manufacturing job losses, and there is no sugarcoating that. If you were you are exposed. 90% of us don't work there. 90% of us work in services.
Well, just quickly, in terms of services, one thing that I see is whether or not businesses can scale.
Yeah.
So if you're a restaurant owner, I went into this restaurant once and I was one of three people in this huge restaurant. They can't necessarily shrink their size overnight. And
the physical size.
The physical size and the number of tables and, you know, all that stuff. So are businesses being affected by that scale issue?
Absolutely. If they have a fixed capacity issue, then the only option they have is to drop their price, perhaps even below cost, in order to cover part of their nut. The other part is the variable cost, which is people. And in essence, in a very Darwinian way, as a business manager, you want to actually let people go or lay them off or not, or slow down hiring before the recession. And right now, before the recovery, you want to start hiring.
Right, that's what I suspect you'll start to see. Well, Lakshman Ashutan, thanks so much for helping us with that. I mean, it really does go together, the measurement part and the sort of anecdotal feelings part. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
He's Managing Director of Economic Cycles Research Institute, market analysis company that's been forecasting recessions and recoveries for decades. Jack Bernstein, what are you going to do today?
We're going to feed a lot of people, one at a time.
All right, good luck to you. Ed Snively, real estate broker in El Centro, California, going to close a deal today?
Well, we certainly hope so, and we're pretty excited about that. And I don't want to minimize the unemployment situation. I think it's a concern for all of us.
But
in our particular area, we do have a very stable government force, including two state prisons, border protection, and customs. And we're really looking out here for green energy, solar, and geothermal.
Economic realities.
As a big booster to our economy.
Well, that's Snively, real estate broker in El Centro, California. Jack Bernstein, caterer and sandwich shop owner in Miami. You know, I talked with someone in a parking lot yesterday as I was getting tape on the economy. He said, I'm an African-American male. The economy goes up or down. I stay where I am, bouncing off the bottom. So a lot of people, which is a really huge part of the story, aren't even measured by any of these statistics. And that was a great conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Headlines now from Femi. Okay.
21 minutes to the top of the hour and a big economic indicator just out this morning. Consumer inflation went up 0.7% in June. And that's the biggest gain in 11 months and is higher than economists expected. And it's due mainly to a surge in gas prices. President Obama will be in the Rose Garden today to talk about the need for Congress to push through legislation on health care. Meanwhile, the president's political organization is launching a series of television ads on health care, and they're intended to prod senators to back the health care effort. The Senate has not yet unveiled its health care plan. The House plan came to light yesterday, weighing in at $1.5 trillion. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is set to deliver what's being billed as a major foreign policy address today. It comes a day before she heads off on an around-the-world trip. And the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center says a tsunami generated in the Pacific Ocean is small and poses no major threat. It issued a warning earlier after a 7.8 magnitude earthquake hit off the coastline of New Zealand. That's Look at Your News headlines for now.
Well, thanks, Femi. And we're, of course, going to be talking about the NAACP's 100th anniversary later.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Huckenberry. An update now on a story we've covered periodically over the last year. For the last 2.5 years, though, in the home province of Mexican President Felipe Calderon, Michoacan, 11,000 people have been killed in drug violence. And it seems over the past 4 days, things are sliding into a state of instability that some have described as more like the Tet Offensive in Vietnam a generation ago. More than a dozen federal agents' bodies have been killed in just the last 4 days alone in Michoacan. Joining us to talk about what's going on in the Mexican drug war is Joan Griot, is a Mexican reporter for Time magazine. He joins us from Mexico City. Joan, this seems to be taking a turn for the worst, and I'm wondering if there's any sort of causality here, or has the government just lost control of the situation?
It certainly is taking a turn for the worse. I mean, this has been a real hammering to the confidence of the government and of the Mexican population. I think one of the reasons that things are really going bad in Michoacan is that this major drug trafficking organization there, known as La Familia, has been attacked by the federal government. And on Saturday morning, one of their top operatives was arrested. And in response to that arrest, the drug gang La Familia launched offensives against federal police throughout the state over the last few days. I mean, they've been attacking police stations every day all over the state with, you know, 40 guys turning up with automatic rifles, grenades, you know, burning cars, shooting people down, and also killing the federal police in ambushes. They've been getting some of these guys off duty, going into their houses, taking them out, executing them, and leaving on the road.
Wow.
So, you know, the cause, I guess, is it's a reaction to the government's attack. It's saying, don't touch us, don't arrest our operatives, or we will hit you back very hard.
How do you assess from Mexico City how much of this is a new aggression on the part of the drug cartels, and how much of it is a consequence of a deterioration of support for the government in Michoacan province?
I would say, I mean, it's a combination of the two things. I mean, Michoacan is a very important state as the home state of the president. That was where the whole campaign against drug cartels started. When Felipe Calderon took office in December 2006, he said, I'm going to start here in my home state. And he moved in thousands of soldiers and federal police to try and, what, in his words, regain control. Say, look, we don't want to lose control of these places anymore. I was on that very first offensive. I saw the soldiers going to cities. And immediately after, there seemed to be a, you know, relative calm. But now you've seen since then, you know, this suddenly losing control there.
Right. So, well, you know, Joan Griot of Time magazine, Felipe Calderon famously said at the end of last year that the Mexican government holds every inch of its territory. I'm wondering if that can be said honestly and candidly now about Felipe Calderon's home province of Michoacan.
Yeah, I think that certainly cannot be said. I think when you have a situation where an organization can launch in one day 8 attacks in different towns on federal police installations, can inflict that kind of loss, I think it's a hard boast to say you control every inch of your territory.
Well, probably nobody says it better than Joan Griot, Mexican reporter for Time magazine, Mexico reporter for Time magazine, on the line from Mexico City, talking about unrest in Michoacan province. Thanks, Joan.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Coming up, we've got a look at how one person now involved with the White House has looked at the retrospective of civil rights and the future of young people in the NAACP. But first, we've got Femi Okeh with the headlines.
To the top of the hour. Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor starts day 3 of her Senate confirmation hearings later this morning. More questions from senators are on the agenda. Southern California has a new congresswoman. Democrat Judy Chu won a special election to fill the House seat left by the Labor Secretary Hilda Solis. Chu becomes the first Chinese-American woman in the House. The CIA is expected to turn over documents to Congress detailing a former program to seek out and kill al-Qaeda leaders.
That's according to congressional officials who spoke with the Associated Press. In international news, Al-Qaeda's number two man tells tells Pakistanis to join the fight against the United States. Ayman al-Zawahiri has a new audio message out, and he also criticized the Pakistani offensive against militants in its northwest region. More than 160 people are feared dead in a plane crash in Iran. A Caspian Airlines flight from Tehran went down in the country's northwest earlier this morning. And that is a look at some of the big stories making headlines.
Thanks, Femi.
Built it all we can, I like the fact that black is black. Way back when in 68, when brothers didn't have it great. They fought back with civil rights and scarred the soul. It took the sight, the common foe you plainly see. On the streets or on TV, segregation was the king. Vietnam was full and swing.
Segregation was the key, but now it's the 100th anniversary of the NAACP. I couldn't resist that, John.
It rhymes. Nice.
The civil rights organization is holding its centennial celebration in New York City, but the question is, how relevant to folks from younger generations, post-civil rights generations? Are there new tasks at hand besides breaking the color line? For that, we're turning to Van Jones. He started out as a civil rights lawyer in San Francisco, and he helped jumpstart the Green Jobs Movement. He's the special advisor to the White House Council on Environmental Quality. Hey, how are you, Van?
I'm doing great. Glad to be with you.
So a lot of people said that President Obama was the epitome of the realization of King's dream. Do you ever feel that you are part of the realization of that dream?
Well, I think we all are. I think the whole country is. And it's almost impossible to imagine the country that he addressed in 1963, where you know, literally people couldn't even sit next to each other in public restaurants. And you know, now we have a president who is the product of a mixed-race union, and we have little African-American children running around on the White House lawn. But I think all of us have a lot to be proud of, because it took you know, all colors and all classes to turn that page together, and we've done that. And now we've got some more pages to turn.
So the NAACP has certainly in the past been instrumental in achieving social justice and change, but some people, particularly people in their 20s and 30s, even in their teens, say it's irrelevant. What do you say to that?
Well, I just think that anytime you have a brand that is 100 years old, you may have younger people who say, oh, well, is this still relevant to me? But when you have young leadership, like you have in Ben Jealous, who is an incredible spokesperson who's under the age of 40 and is bringing such dynamic new vision, I think that you got to look down the road. And I think you're going to see new missions and new challenges, new opportunities for all of the groups working for justice.
Well, it seems like there's been a real transformation. I mean, they weren't talking about NAACP brands 100 years ago. That's very Van Jonesian. But it seems to me that if we move from the leadership crisis that the NAACP was undergoing really just a few years ago, and talk about a torch being passed to a new group of leaders, the leaders that that torch is passed to are suddenly, with an African-American president, not responsible for activism. They're responsible for deliverables, producing jobs, producing economic outcomes and results. Is that part of your responsibility now, Van Jones?
It certainly is, and I'm excited to be a part of an administration like President Obama's administration that has put jobs front and center, and the idea of economic opportunity for all Americans. And at the same time, the way you have the jobs of tomorrow is that you make the products of tomorrow. The products of tomorrow are advanced automobiles, advanced energy, renewable energy, wind turbines, solar panels.
At the same time, though, when you talk about a promise, you also have to talk about paying for that promise. And there's a whole political term you're familiar with, unfunded mandate. And although the president has said that he wanted to spend $150 billion over the next decade for issues including green jobs, other environmental issues, is that money on the table, and have you gotten any of it, and have you been able to create any jobs yet?
Well, what's amazing about this president is that, you know, even by mid-February, in signing the Recovery Act, which is $787 billion Recovery Act, to not only jumpstart our economy but to strengthen it for the long term, there were $60 billion, $60 billion with a B, in the recovery package. So he talked about $150 billion, so there's $60 billion really right off the bat for clean energy, for energy efficiency, for smart batteries, for a smarter grid. That probably represented the biggest single investment in clean energy technology in the history of the country.
But has your office gotten any of that money?
Well, I work in the White House, so our job is to help to coordinate among the agencies and departments that have gotten that money. The Department of Energy did a remarkable job this summer getting $2.5 billion out the door for energy efficiency, for weatherization, so people can start getting their energy bills cut, and we can put people to work blowing in clean, non-toxic insulation, replacing windows and doors that don't fit.
Well, I read your book, The Green Collar Economy, How One Solution Can Fix Our Two Biggest Problems. I'm suspecting that it's not enough for Van Jones to sit there in the White House congratulating the work that's been done already. What are the unmet needs? What are the tough problems going forward?
The first thing you've got to do, you've got to get the public investments right. And I think we did that in large part with the recovery package, again, $60 billion. But you've also got to get the public rules right. And that is our next challenge. In other words, we want to change the laws in this country so that the clean forms of energy are the profitable forms.
I mean, I do have to go back at this question of where you are in terms of achieving your vision, because you're someone who's very dogged. You've achieved just about everything that I know that you've set out to do. But if this climate bill doesn't pass, will you be stuck in a position of being a cheerleader who cannot actually produce the jobs that you want to produce?
No. The good thing is that we have multiple levers to move the country forward. And, the climate bill is central and it's critical. There are other opportunities to move things forward. The private sector wants to move in this direction. The last part of the economy to freeze during this recent downturn was the green part. We were still growing wind and solar companies, deep into the fourth quarter of last year. And the first part's likely to unthaw are the green parts.
Well, just final question. I got to know you in the Bay Area when you were working with the Ella Baker Center, which was transitioning into doing work with green jobs. And as you know, a lot of people who have been denied opportunity don't want to be stuck with false hope. Do you ever worry that by putting out a vision that has not yet been achieved, that there are going to be people who are going to say, oh, I thought this was great. I thought I was going to get a job. Have you ever faced having people that you trained not be able to find a job? And what happens then?
Well, first of all, yeah, I have had that experience. When I was working in Oakland, and you would get a young person who, did everything right and worked really hard and got through a program and then found that they were not going to be hired, and it's heartbreaking. But the alternative is to have no dream at all, to have no hope at all. And, Dr. King, you think his knees weren't shaken when he was standing up there saying what he wanted to see? And you think there weren't people standing behind him with their arms crossed saying this is just selling false hope? I think the alternative is to have no dream at all. And the great thing is that we've got a president that has, it's not the color of his skin, it's the color of his dream for America. He has a green dream for this country, and he is willing to go to the mat to try to deliver on it, and I'm proud to be working with him.
Well, it's a perfect place to end it. Van Jones, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
And Van Jones is special advisor to the White House Council on Environmental Quality. He's also the author of The Green Collar Economy, How One Solution Can Fix Our Two Biggest Problems.
Whatever the color of your economy, we are asking you to help us track the numbers today. People are starting to say that the recession may be over.
By April, it was clear the recession would be over this summer. I don't think the man in the street will feel that until the fall when they're looking in the rearview mirror, because really your gut feel is a rearview mirror feel.
Your takeaway from Lachman Achuthan, who's managing director of Economic Cycle Research Institute. We were talking about whether you feel like you're in a boom or in a bust right now. What's your feeling economic indicator-wise?
I am literally, as of the last 2 weeks, a lagging indicator of the economy.
Oh, it sounds like you lost your job.
Exactly correct, after 10 years.
That's what Jim told me yesterday at my neighborhood grocery store. What are the indicators you've been seeing or feeling in your life? Call us at 877-8MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org, where there's full coverage of Todd Zwillick and the Sotomayor hearings.
I'm Farai Chidea.
I'm John Hockenberry. You are at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Of judges and bullies in the Senate.
She's a good judge.
She can be a bit of a bully.
She's very intelligent.
She abuses lawyers.
She's good.
She's nasty to lawyers.
She's friendly, smart.
She will attack lawyers for making an argument she does not like. And the strangled cries
of lawyers in love. Abusing lawyers, bullying lawyers, what could possibly be wrong with that? If lawyers are in love, maybe we need a second look at the judge. The judging of judges by lawyers in the Senate continues. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
And we have full coverage. Good morning, everyone. Wednesday morning, July 15th. I'm John Hockenberry, along with Farai Jadeh. Good morning, Farai.
Hey, John.
The legal discussions got underway at the Sotomayor hearings. We all heard it. And before the Senate Judiciary Committee, we'll have coverage. And we're going to look at the leadership of the NAACP with Chief Benjamin Jealous. That's a great conversation. And it's a mystery food all over America. The hero, the gyro, gyro hero. What do you call it? We'll find out. We're going to get to the bottom of a food mystery on Wednesday, Food Day here on The Takeaway. But joining us now is David Koppel, Research Director of the Independence Institute and a policy analyst with the Cato Institute. David, if Judge Sonia Sotomayor is known to be tough on lawyers, you heard it right there, is that altogether a bad thing?
Well, I think a judge has every right to expect that a lawyer in the courtroom is going to be very well prepared and not waste the court's time. On the other hand, that's not an excuse for unprofessional behavior or for bullying. A lot of what Judge Sotomayor's biographical presentation is her empathy. She understands what it might be like to be discriminated against or bullied in a workplace context. So given that that's especially an important part of her worldview, when she's in the position of power over someone in a workplace, she ought to be behaving with professional courtesy and demeanor.
Thanks. David Koppel is going to stay with us with more of his critique of Sonia Sotomayor. And Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent, is also going to join us. First, in the headlines, fresh numbers out this morning on inflation. Last month, it shot up by 0.7% for consumers like you and me. Biggest jump in 11 months. Analysts cite rising prices at the gas pumps. Later this hour, we'll also get new info on how American manufacturers are faring with new numbers on factory production. President Obama talks health care in the Rose Garden today. The House has a $1.5 trillion bill on the table. It's got to go to the Senate, though.
More than 160 people are feared dead in a plane crash in Iran. A Caspian Airlines flight from Tehran went down in the country's northwest. Also, Al-Qaeda number two man tells Pakistanis to join the fight against the U.S. Ayman al-Zawahiri has a new audio message out. He also criticizes the Pakistani offensive against militants in the northwest.
So it's like Al-Qaeda is on the defensive, but Femi, okay, we'll have more about that. Wall Street opens this hour. Looks like a positive opening. The S&P will begin at 9:05. The Nasdaq kicks off at 17:99. Some economists are saying the recession may be over soon. They can see it on the horizon, but do you feel it yet?
Hi, this is Larry Duffy. I am in the office furniture business. I own a dealership in Manhattan, and we are definitely a lagging economic indicator. I don't expect our business to feel the recovery for a very long time.
Where do you stand? Are you a snapshot of the economy's future or of its past? Give us some hope or tell us some sobering realities. Your story is at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Farai Jadeh. And questions about demeanor and questions of arcane economic legal theory, I think, were a fair characterization of the hearings yesterday. Day two for Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
And ethnicity always.
Ethnicity, definitely. That was definitely where the demeanor and the fireworks took place. And there was a pretty darn good caption of the entire picture of the hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Todd Zwillick's tweet feed, Twitter feed, which you can find at thetakeaway.org. He was at the hearings all day yesterday and joins us now. Also, David Koppel works for the Libertarian Think Tank's Independence Institute, and the Cato Institute is also with us. He spoke there at the top of the hour. Todd, first of all, you were there all day. The fireworks about demeanor and ethnicity and also some very arcane discussions, that pretty much wrapped it up for the day.
Yeah, the conversation swung from, of course, the empathy question to the Second Amendment, to the Commerce Clause and the 14th Amendment, a little bit of the Fifth Amendment, and then, of course, John, the issue of demeanor that you're talking about. And this, the demeanor being Sonia Sotomayor's judicial demeanor and her behavior on the bench. This kind of came out of the blue a little bit, but this was one of the hot points of the hearings yesterday. Of course, Senator Lindsey Graham, conservative Republican of South Carolina, got his turn to question and turned to a book called The Almanac of the Federal Judiciary. I want you to listen to this first cut. Here's how we started out.
I like you, by the way, for whatever that matters. Since I may vote for you, that ought to matter to you.
Okay, I like
it's
you.
It's always bad there, news.
Right. I like you. There's the hug, and yeah. Here comes the knee to the gut.
One thing that stood out about your record is that when you look at the almanac of the federal judiciary, lawyers anonymously rate judges in terms of temperament. And here's what they said about you. She's a terror on the bench. She's temperamental, excitable. She seems angry. She's overly aggressive, not very judicial. She does not have a very good temperament. She abuses lawyers. She really lacks judicial temperament. She believes in an out of control. She behaves in an out of control manner. She makes inappropriate outbursts. She is nasty to lawyers. She will attack lawyers for making an argument she does not like. She can be a bit of a bully.
She can be a bit of a bully. So, did Lindsey Graham go right at her or what? Republicans trying to come up with some criticism of Sonia Sotomayor.
I mean, is this credible stuff, though? I mean, it sounds a little bit like stuff you'd find, you know, scratched on, some library table or something.
Well, except that it is out of the Almanac of the Federal Judiciary, where he's right. Lawyers who come before the Second Circuit do rate the judges, and they have rated her. Sonia Sotomayor got her chance to respond to all of this intense criticism that Graham threw at her. Listen to this.
When I ask lawyers tough questions, it's to give them an opportunity to explain their positions on both sides and to persuade me that they're right.
I don't know. It just seems to me lawyers getting tough questions from judges is kind of like the job description. But I don't know. She's going to get confirmed, and there must have been people who were crowing about her yesterday.
There were. And in fact, since Lindsey Graham turned to the Almanac of the Federal Judiciary with all these nasty comments about Sonia Sotomayor, she's excitable, she's nasty, she's a bully, and she's angry. Senator Ben Cardin, who's from Maryland, who's also on the judiciary, well, he cracked that book, too, and he made sure to come out to talk to reporters afterward to give his own version of the Almanac of the Federal Judiciary. Listen to Cardin here.
She's very good. She is bright. She's a good judge. She's very smart. She's friendly smart. She's intellectually tough. She's very intelligent. She has a very good common sense approach to law. She looks at the practical issues. She is good. She's an exceptional judge overall. She's engaged in oral argument. She's well prepared. She participates actively in oral argument. She's extremely hardworking and always prepared. And the list goes on and on and on.
E for effort, good penmanship. I mean, I don't know. There's something slightly infantile about the demeanor question, but it is definitely important to those lawyers in the Senate, right?
It's important to lawyers in the Senate, and it's also important to these proceedings because she has a 17-year record on the bench. Even Lindsey Graham, who came at her, has, of course, famously now said, unless you have a meltdown, you're going to be confirmed. And it did appear to a lot of people in the room that he was turning up the heat to see if he could cause the meltdown after he said that.
Yeah, well,
so they're giving it a shot.
And he wasn't successful, but it was all interesting stuff. Todd Zwillich, stay with us. David Koppel is also with us. He works for the Libertarian Think Tank's Independent Institute and the Cato Institute. And he's going to be testifying before the end of these hearings as a minority witness critical of Judge Sotomayor. And we've been trying to present critical arguments that don't involve some of the issues that are possibly of most importance to senators. David Koppel, first of all, what would be your key argument against Sonia Sotomayor joining the high court?
Well, I was invited to testify as an expert on the Second Amendment, so I'll be talking about her record on right-to-arms issues and really the disregard and that she's shown for the exercise of those rights by millions of people and really the very glib and shallow legal reasoning she's used in cases where she's dismissively rejected arguments that people have constitutional rights to arms.
Well, David, respond to this. This is something that Sotomayor said in a question from Pat Leahy on the 14th this week.
I understand that how important the right to bear arms is to many, many Americans. In fact, one of my godchildren is a member of the NRA, and I have friends who hunt.
Hunting friends and NRA godchildren. Is that enough?
It's nice that that comes out in time for the hearing, but I think if you look at the record of what she's done on the bench, rather than this some of my best friends are type of argument, her judicial opinions are pretty contemptuous and dismissive of arms rights claims.
David, do you think that you have enough of a pattern to judge her beyond this specific issue of the right to bear arms? What do you think of some of her other legal decisions thus far?
Oh, I think her decisions on property rights or in the case of the Portchester case are extremely disturbing. And I think her handling of the Ricci case is not only wrong in a policy matter, and Senator
That's
Obama
race and
says
hiring.
You can vote right, and but also the way she handled that as Justice Judge Cabranes pointed out, was really a pretty serious violation of judicial integrity and ethics.
Now, how would it bear on ethics, David Koppel? And again,
because
you're with
the
Cato Institute.
The judges of the Second Circuit have a procedure when they handle a case by doing merely a summary order. They're trusting each other that if one panel says, oh, yeah, this case is nothing, it was just some particular facts, and that's it, and we don't need as the group, the Second Circuit as a whole, to even worry about this kind of thing. And that's what she tried to make it look like when it quite clearly wasn't. It was something that, at the least, raised significant and important issues of law. And she really stepped far outside the norms of how Second Circuit judges are supposed to handle summary orders and really, I think, worked to conceal what was going on in that case from her other colleagues on the circuit.
Different groups of people bring different standards to what they think a Supreme Court justice should have as a North Star. If you had to name one quality that a Supreme Court justice should have, what would it be, and do you think she has it?
I'd say love for every word of the Constitution and a willingness to enforce every bit of it equally. And what we've seen is unequal protection from her, that some things get very strongly enforced, and I think she has a good record on some First Amendment cases, but a really poor record on other rights. And I don't think you can divide constitutional rights into front of the bus rights and back of the bus rights. They all ought to be protected equally strongly.
Well, that discussion on the Second Amendment will take place in possibly questioning today, but certainly when David Koppel testifies. He's with the Independence Institute and a policy analyst with the Cato Institute. He will be testifying. Will it be Thursday or just sometime before the end of the week, David?
Could be later in the day Thursday or possibly on Friday morning, but right. It all depends on how much the senators talk, and one can never underestimate that.
No, never can underestimate that. As we mentioned, David Koppel invited to testify on Second Amendment issues in the Sotomayor confirmation hearings. Todd Zwillich, what happens today?
More questioning, John. There's only one Republican left who hasn't had his first round, Senator John Cornyn of Texas, conservative Republican, and he may get to the Second Amendment. And it's interesting to watch him because he's walking this fine line. He's from Texas, lots of Hispanic voters there, but he's also so far against this nominee. So got to watch how he walks the line between criticizing her but not criticizing her too harshly. And then what's interesting after that, Democrats have a 4-vote majority on this committee because of their 60-vote majority. So 4 Democrats get to ask questions unanswered by Republicans, including Specter and Franken, and then they go into a closed-door meeting with the FBI, where the FBI briefs senators on their background check of Sotomayor, things like tax issues, any other things that come up in the background check.
So things are moving.
Things are definitely moving. And then more questions.
Well, Todd, I was looking online. You have a reputation for bullying senators. Did you know that, actually?
I do.
You could see Todd's tweets from the Twitter feed on thetakeaway.org. Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent, covering the Sotomayor hearings. I'm just kidding, Todd.
Hey, that's my job.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Farai Chidea. Continued weakness in the manufacturing sector. Industrial production dips a smaller than expected 0.4%, but the weakness continues. You know, we eat every day, but on Wednesday on The Takeaway, we talk about food. It's kind of a recession favorite, lunch meat, and it goes back a long way with me, the gyro or the gyro or the hero. Let's face it, most of us don't even know how to pronounce the name of this luncheon special, this snack food. I actually tried to make it once. I did the recipe. You mash up a bunch of meat, put it in a cake pan, bake it in the oven. It tasted great with spices and everything, but it wasn't a gyro, and there's a very good reason why. And the why comes from New York Times business reporter David Siegel, who set out to find the story behind the gyro, why the meat is the way that it is. And it's actually a serious mystery. David Siegel, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thanks for taking on this case.
Yeah,
what is that meat, and how did they get it that way?
The meat is a combination of lamb and beef. It's mostly beef, about 15% lamb, most of them. And the way they get it that way is they mince it in an enormous vat. And they blend spices or oregano and breadcrumbs along the way. It ends up looking like a paste, like a, almost like hummus.
Now, that you're describing is meatloaf, sort of Greek or something kind of meatloaf. But there's an added element that actually makes it very, very different from any other kind of meatloaf.
You speak of the hydraulic pressure?
Yes.
There is hydraulic pressure applied at the end. They first check for bone and metal, just as a precaution. And then they...
Tooth and nails as well?
Whatever might be in there that shouldn't be in there. And then they use hydraulic pressure to pump out these cones, which wind up on cylinders, and then they're flash frozen.
And so that's the thing that spins around that they carve the meat off of that doesn't resemble any animal part that I've ever seen.
That's right.
All right, so first of all, what made you want to go and get to the bottom of this? And there's actually a great American ingenuity story behind the entire hydraulic pressure part of this story.
The thing that made me interested was I was walking down the street about a month and a half ago, and I saw a photo of a young lady. She looks like she's a blonde in her early 20s. And she, I'd seen her face all over the place, and it looked like a photo from the early 80s. And I thought to myself, who is that woman? I've seen her all over New York City. I wonder if she knows that her face is all over New York City. And she turned out to be the first Kronos girl. Kronos is the world's largest makers of gyros. And so I wanted to find out who is she and does she understand that her face is all over New York City. Actually, never found out. The one guy who would know has passed away. So I never got to the bottom of that mystery. But I did end up going to Kronos and finding out how they make gyros. And I spent some time just walking around the factory to get to know that place.
And where is the factory?
It's in the south side of Chicago. It's in this sort of dead-end industrial street. And it's this massive place that just sells, that just makes gyros and flash freezes them.
So there's nothing really Greek about gyros, right?
There is something very Greek about gyros. The American part of this, I mean, gyros has been made one at a time in kitchens for years. So it had been people doing exactly what you did, which was mashing them by hand and then making the cones themselves. Someone came up with the idea of mass producing gyros, and that's an American concept.
Wow.
And so I wanted to find out who that American was, because it turns out that there are basically five gyro magnates in Chicago, five guys who very early in the 70s, in the mid-70s, almost simultaneously came up with the idea of making a fortune with gyros. And I knew who those five guys were. So I just started calling them around to see, like, when was your factory? Who did you come up with this idea? And it took a few calls, but I finally found a guy named Pete Parthenis, and he said it was his idea
to make the machine
to mass produce the gyro.
To mass produce the
gyro,
right?
And I was going from like making one car in a garage to creating a factory to crank out
the
cars.
The Henry Ford, of
if
gyros.
You will,
yes.
So Pete Parthenis said that. He was a Henry Ford. And then there was one more guy to call, and I called him, a man named Andre, and he said, actually, it wasn't Pete Parthenis. It was a man named John Garlick.
John Garlick?
Yeah.
And so
I thought
the
he was
Parthenis
kidding.
Mystery is busted. Okay.
Right. So
I thought... And John Garlick came up with what exactly?
John Garlick had come to Chicago from Milwaukee in 1973, looking for a partner for his brand new gyro factory that he had opened in Milwaukee. And Pete Parthenis at that time was making the rotisseries. He hadn't figured out that the money was in the meat, and he partnered up with John Garlick. And
great name.
It is a great name. Ideal.
Fabulous name.
And they were in business for a couple months, but it didn't really work out. Pete Parthenis said that when he did his due diligence and went to visit the home of John Garlick and his wife Margaret Garlick, there were pot plants in the bathtub, and he said,
entrepreneurs, I guess we call
I guess
them.
That's why they taste so good.
And his lawyer said to him, "You can't go into business with this man. You're not hip enough." But they went into business anyway, and it didn't work out. And after about 3 months, they split up. So I said to Pete Parthenis, "Well, where is John Garlick? Who is this John Garlick?" And he said, "He's a mystery. He was a question mark. He came from nowhere." So I set about trying to find John Garlick. And I found a woman named Margaret Garlick who lives in Orlando, and I called her, and she said, yes, that was my husband.
Who made the machine.
Who came up with this idea, like, let's make a mass-produced gyro. And it turns out that he'd passed away in 1994. I said, well, tell me about him. She said, well, he was this big guy. He was a very, very appealing guy. He was a Marine. He was a couple hundred pounds, shaggy hair. I was like, was he Greek? And she said, no, he was Jewish.
So a Jewish guy from Chicago
comes
up with the machine that mass produces the gyro and creates a business worth how much?
Well, each of the guys who was involved in the creation of the gyro were the early gyro guys. They all made millions of dollars. I mean, Pete Parthenis made millions of dollars. So I asked Margaret Garlick, where did this, if this guy's not Greek, where did this idea come from? And she said, it came from me. And I said, well, where did you get it? She said, I was watching What's My Line one day at home, and there was a man carving meat off a gyro. And I thought that was the greatest thing I'd ever seen. And I called my husband, who was then a Cadillac salesman, and he immediately quit his job, and they opened this gyro factory. It did so well that they ended up going to Chicago and looking for a partner, which they found in Pete Parthenis.
Well, from a game show to changing lunches all around America, it's the John Garlick, Margaret Garlick story as told by David Siegel, New York Times business reporter. The mystery of the hero, the gyro, solved. Thank you, David. And have a great lunch, won't you all?
Well, we have another mystery, but this one is of the sad sort. Coming up next, we're going to talk about a fatal plane crash in Iran. The fourth scary airline story in the past 6 weeks. Are planes not safe, or is this just a coincidence? Stay tuned to find out.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Farai Jadeya. A pattern of airline accidents. We'll find out coming up. First headlines from Femi. Okay.
At 28 minutes to the top of the hour, it's day three of the confirmation hearings for the Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor just getting underway now. Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy is actually speaking to Judge Sotomayor right now. He is the Judiciary Chairman. Now, Sotomayor will continue taking questions from the Senate Judiciary Committee members today. Southern California has a new congresswoman. Democrat Judy Chu won a special election to fill the House seat left by the Labor Secretary Hilda Solis. She will represent a heavily Democratic area that covers part of Los Angeles and its eastern suburbs. Chu also becomes the first Chinese-American woman in the House. Federal investigators say that the signaling system on a portion of the Washington Metro continues to fail. They have replaced different pieces of the equipment, but it hasn't helped the problem. All the failures happened close to where the deadly crash occurred last month. And in entertainment news, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince is in theatres today. It's the sixth Potter movie, and it's pretty long. For some young fans, the length of the movie is tough on their bladders. Here's Harry Potter star Daniel Radcliffe with this cautionary story.
There was this little boy who was trying to wee as quickly as humanly possible in order to get back to the film, and he was absolutely mental in the toilets, desperate to get back and see the rest of the film.
Going for a wee is not a term that muggles use. Only if you're a British muggle, it means going to the restroom.
And well, just, thank you for that. Thanks for helping us with that.
I didn't feel it needed much translation. The film is actually 2 hours and 33 minutes, not including the adverts. Harry Potter fans, you have been warned.
Oh, well, Femi, thank you for that warning. I will take it to heart. And thanks for the headlines. Moving on to a story that's just unfolding in Iran today. State TV reports that 168 people are dead in a tragic plane crash in the northwest. The Caspian plane commercial jet made a deep gouge in the dirt field where it crashed. It essentially crumbled on impact with much of the wreckage in small pieces. This is the fourth in a series of major airline stories in the past 6 weeks, from the crash of Air France and Yemenia Airways planes a few weeks ago to yesterday when on a Southwest flight, a hole opened up in the passenger cabin in mid-flight. Now, that plane made a safe emergency landing in West Virginia. So what's happening here? Are planes getting unsafer, or is this just a coincidence? First, we're going to go to more of the story from the crash in Iran. We've got Borzu Daragahi, Beirut bureau chief for the LA Times. So can you tell us the latest about this story, including, you know, what kind of people were on the plane and where it was headed?
Well, it was a plane headed from Tehran to the Armenian capital, Yerevan. It crashed just minutes before noon, about 16 minutes after taking off in a rural part of Iran, of Iran's Qazvin province, just northwest of the capital. According to officials, there is nobody who survived this plane. Among those who were killed were 10 members of the Iranian junior judo squad, including two coaches, and eight players traveling to Yerevan for a summer training camp. Iran and Armenia have very good ties. Iran has a significant Armenian minority that has stronger and stronger ties to Armenia and to the capital there. So there's some travel there. So probably there were a lot of people there who are ethnic Armenian.
You mentioned the ties between Armenia and Iran, and obviously we know that Iran has had quite a fractious relationship with the United States. Is there a possibility that the politics of sanctions played into this?
Well, that's what Iranian officials and some ordinary people, even who are not supporters of the government, have been saying for years, that the U.S. sanctions on the sales of aircraft and aircraft parts to Iran have been hurting ordinary civilians, making it impossible for them to travel as safely as possible. This airline, Caspian Airlines, uses mostly Tupolev, Russian-made Tupolev planes, which many Iranians, I'm not sure about experts, but many ordinary Iranians believe are unsafe and not up to the quality standards of the Western airplanes. But, you know, maybe we shouldn't be so haughty with two Airbuses crashing into the sea in the last month or so.
Well, you, as the Beirut bureau chief for the LA Times, must have taken probably some dodgy flights, different places. Were you ever on one of these planes?
Yeah, I've been on Caspian Airlines, I've been on Kish Airlines, I've been on Asiman Airlines, all of the minor Iranian airlines. And, you know, typically what happens is you need a flight at the last minute. You want to fly Iran Air or Emirates Airlines to Dubai or something, and they're full up. And so you end up just crossing your heart and taking one of the what would many people consider lesser airlines because of the airplanes they use and the lack of scrutiny that they're under.
Well, Borzu Daragahi, thank you so much. Borzu Daragahi, Beirut bureau chief for the LA Times. We also have with us Graham Warwick, senior technology editor of Aviation Week. Graham, can you tell us a little bit about the kind of plane that was involved in this fatal crash?
It was a relatively young airplane. It was delivered in 1987, and it was a Tupolev, we think, a Tupolev Tu-154. Which is a sort of a Russian equivalent of the Boeing 727. It's a little bit more sort of modern than that, but obviously the 727 has pretty much disappeared from our skies. But it's still the 124 is still pretty common in the former CIS and other parts of the world, in China and things like that.
When you think about the spate of different airline incidents, including, you know, the one here in the U.S., the Southwest flight that developed a hole, something that I'm assuming was, you know, metal fatigue or something that certainly just didn't happen in 1 second, what's the state of play with airline safety? Has it changed over the past few years?
It's kind of tempting to sort of look at these this spate of accidents and sort of and conclude that airline safety is deteriorating. The truth actually is that if you look at it over a period of years, it is improving, and it has been steadily improving. But there are spikes, and that appears to be in part due to just simply probability. They sort of, you know, they don't happen at an evenly spaced apart. You do get these upward trends every now and then. There was one in 2005. We were doing quite well, and then there was a big spike in 2005. And then after 2005, the rate sort of went back to the historic improvement. And the other thing is, when you look at the accidents that we're talking about, the incidents we're talking about, when you actually sort of look at them, they're very different. So you can't actually group them and say there's one thing we can fix and these would all go away.
So, and very quickly, don't panic, question mark?
I think it's don't panic. You know, modern equipment, well-capitalized airlines, well-trained air crew should be safe. The two that we talk about, Yemenia and Iran, are both in parts of the world where the accident rate is higher than the rest of the world. But in the West, it's still pretty safe.
All right. Thanks much, Graham Warwick, senior technology editor of Aviation Week. And coming up, we are going to speak with the president of the NAACP, which is 100 years old.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry with Farai Chidea. So all is not well in the American team in the Tour de France, which enters its second week. Lance Armstrong, of course, is competitive. He joined the team, but it was not necessarily suspected that he would actually try to win. but it seems that he's definitely going for broke here. And the relations between Lance Armstrong and Alberto Contador, who are both vying for another Tour de France win and leadership on their team, it's very, very tense. And to talk about the Tour de France and the standings and what's likely to happen as we move forward is the Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, who joins us here in the studio. As you know, I'm not a big fan of Lance Armstrong, but it seems like he's joined the team as a kind of ceremonial, emotional gesture and is now trying to Bigfoot everybody else. Am I wrong?
Oh, well, some people think that his bid to get the yellow jersey in each stage is to be like the to promote Live Strong, his cancer fighting program. And so some people think that it's just a promotional opportunity. However,
he's a survivor of testicular cancer, we should remind people.
Correct. I'm sorry. So then the other thing is that's really awesome is that some people also speculate that he took 3 years off, not to just take 3 years off and to retire, but actually he took 3 years off so his body could recover and he could come back at full strength.
And what evidence is there of this, and how are the other members of the team responding?
Well, generally what teams are supposed to do is that they're supposed to have a designated leader, and they're supposed to organize themselves around that designated leader. They're supposed to push back any other riders and prevent the other riders from getting there. Lance Armstrong is the golden boy. He's the guy they want to win. He's the guy with the experience, with the years, and he's put in the hard work. He understands the cornering. He understands all the nuance of the course. So what they're supposed to do is set it up so he's supposed to get ahead. The challenge you have with Astanza is that they have a very difficult situation with two guys that are legitimate leaders, and there's actually no clear indication of how they're going to manage this for the rest of the tour.
Now, you're referring to the team Astana.
Astana.
Now, that is the name of the U.S. team, or the name of the team that Armstrong is on?
Yeah, it's not the U.S. team, actually. They have riders from all over the country, all over the world, actually. They have like 9 different countries that are represented in their tour. And they actually, out of the top 5 riders right now, 4 of the top 5 riders are from that team.
Now, you know, this is a sport that is known for doping, that is known for all kinds of performance-enhancing drug abuses. Is there any sense that Lance Armstrong's presence increases that controversy or scrutiny, or reduces it?
Well, to be completely fair to him, he's been tested and he's come back favorable in those tests every single time. So I think there's always going to be speculation with a guy who's the tops at his sport in a sport that's notoriously riddled with performance-enhancing drugs. But you can't legitimately say yet that Lance Armstrong, until he tests positive for something, that he's actually guilty.
I guess what I don't understand is how come he's not the Derek Jeter of cycling, in the sense that he does have this clean record on paper, but yet people aren't giving him a pass.
I think there's a little bit of his attitude, and I think cyclers in general have a ego boost. I think Cavendish, who won the sprint yesterday, a lot of people, he's 24, he's young, he's brash. A lot of folks were a little annoyed about how he acts off the race. So I think sometimes you think about cyclists and they're these arrogant guys, and that's what Lance Armstrong is. Just he fits the mold.
Can Contador beat Armstrong in the last second?
Without a doubt. I think that's the time trials. We're getting out of the hills, we're getting into the sprint, and that's where Contador does well.
The rivalry between Alberto Contador and Lance Armstrong in the Tour de France, which enters its second week. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks so much, Ibrahim.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea here with John Hockenberry, and it is happy birthday time, 100th birthday for the NAACP. In a few minutes, we'll talk about their future with their current and young president, Benjamin Jealous. He's just 36 years old, and that's coming up after the headlines with Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much, Farai. Just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Day 3 of Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor's hearings are underway, and she's already defending questions about her now famous statement on wise Latino women on the bench.
It is clear from the attention that my words have gotten and the manner in which it has been understood by some people that my words failed. They didn't work.
But Sotomayor says that she still stands by the message of the overall speech, that she considers her Latina heritage when she's deciding cases. Questions from senators will continue through the day. President Obama talks health care in the Rose Garden today. The House has a $1.5 trillion bill on the table, and that includes tax hikes for the wealthy. The CIA is expected to turn over documents to Congress detailing a former program to seek out and kill al-Qaeda leaders, and that's according to congressional officials who spoke with the Associated Press. In international news, al-Qaeda's number two man tells Pakistanis to join the fight against the U.S. Ayman al-Zawahiri has a new audio message out, and he also criticized the Pakistani offensive against militants in its northwest. That's a look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi. This week, the NAACP kicked off a six-day convention celebrating its 100th anniversary. Founded a century ago, the civil rights organization could be considered an arcane institution with aging members and old ideas. But even though Barack Obama has become our first African-American president, the NAACP sees its work as far from finished. Who better to lead the organization then in the 21st century than someone in his 30s? We're talking about Benjamin Todd Jealous. Last year, at the age of 35, he became the organization's youngest president, and he joins us now to discuss his vision for the NAACP and how he's going to take on the challenges of race relations and equality. Welcome, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm great. Now, does it ruffle your feathers when we use the word arcane? Do you ever think of this organization as arcane or perhaps having teetered on the brink?
Well, yeah, I thought perhaps you were talking about the U.S. Senate. the truth is that throughout the history of this country, the people who lead in politics and basic community activism tend to come from those near or beyond retirement age and those near or below college age. And that's very much what the heart of the membership of this association tends to be. These are two generations of people who have two things in common. On the one hand, they're very eager to see the world change. One is about to leave, who wants to define their legacy. So my focus, as far as getting people, in their late 20s, in their 30s, in their 40s, back engaged with this organization, is to really do two things. One is to make it plain about the sorts of issues that we face right now, failing schools, short supply of jobs, and an even shorter supply of good jobs, real crisis in our prison system and our basic system of safety and justice in this country. And then the next is to make it easy for people to, get involved.
But Ben Jealous, you've got Eric Holder, the Attorney General, there at the NAACP convention. You've got the President of the United States at the convention. How do you maintain the credibility of the NAACP and maintain its independence from the powers that be, the actual institutions of power, when there must be such a temptation to do a full embrace here?
Well, we're a big tent. People come to the big tent, to speak to constituents from across the country and to people who they know are really engaged in the fight for civil rights. I mean, there are a lot of people who have compared this president to past President Lincoln. And I've made it very clear that if he wants to play Lincoln, I'm happy to play Frederick Douglass. I mean, the reality then, as now, is that when they're right, they're right, and we support them and we push them. And when they're wrong, well, we have to let them know that too.
Now, flashback in your mind's eye or your past life to what it must have been like in 1909 when the NAACP was founded. Perhaps, tell me a story that you've heard about the early days of the NAACP.
The most important thing is that back then, in 1909, when this small group of dreamers got together in an apartment in lower Manhattan and decided in that apartment that they would end the appalling practice of lynch mob justice, because there had been a race riot in Springfield, Illinois, the hometown of President Lincoln. 40 black families had been pushed out of town. Black men had their throats slit and then were hung from trees, and not hung to kill them, but hung to put them on display. Is that they were willing to dream really big, urgently needed, bold dreams, to then think as organizers and outline the steps that would need to happen to win, and then to pursue those dreams really for decades. And so our first convention happened just a few months thereafter. We were founded on the birthday of President Lincoln, February 12th, 1909, when he would have been 100 had he been able to live. But just a few months later, they brought in dozens of progressives from around the country, primarily black church leaders, who then were able to take this movement back into the corners of the country that needed the fight against lynch mob justice most. And that formula, you know, dream bold dreams, break them down into achievable steps, practice discipline, and pursue them until you win, has been our strategy since. It's our secret for success.
Let me just jump in and ask a very specific question. Now we are seeing a fairly staggering rise in black unemployment. It's at 13.6% now compared to 8.2% for whites. There's always a huge gap. But in the age of Obama, which is also the age of recession, black folks are not faring well. Every month, the black unemployment rate goes up. And let me just sharpen the point by saying there seems to have been some disagreement between the former president, Bruce Gordon, and between the chairman, Julian Bond, over how much economics factor into what the NAACP should do. So how big of an issue is getting black people jobs to you?
You know, we're actually in firm agreement that jobs are a big part of the agenda. We're focused not just on, you know, full employment, if you will, but also on job quality. I mean, let's not forget that slavery was a full employment economy. So, you know, job quality counts for a lot. There's a lot of children in this country who are neglected each day, not because their parents don't have a job, but because they have to have too many jobs. And so, you know, while we fight to increase jobs, while we worked, you know, to push the green job legislation and related climate change bills through Congress, we also push to improve job quality. That's why the Employee Free Choice Act is so important. And we've got to keep focused on that. We can't be lulled into a conversation that is only about how many black people have jobs. We also have to ask the question, and how good are those jobs? Can you support a family on that job?
What do you want President Obama to say when he addresses the membership of the NAACP? What will you be listening for that's critical to you?
You know, I guess, you know, we want some acknowledgement of our role in ensuring that this day could come when a black man could get onto Air Force One. We also want to hear acknowledgement that this country has a long way to go. When you have a day like 2 days ago where, you know, on the one hand you see photos of the president getting onto Air Force One, on the other hand you see photos of black children can't get into a swimming pool, you know, it shows that while many people that can surmount the barriers in our society, there are still big barriers for many of us, and we have to stay focused on those. And we also want to hear some acknowledgement, quite frankly, of the parts of the social contract that still need to be extended. For instance, the fight for, you know, to end this healthcare crisis in this country, the fight to ensure that all kids can go to good schools, and the fight to ensure that this period of mass incarceration of black people will be brought to an end by sane policy.
That's 36-year-old Benjamin Jealous, the president of the NAACP, and he joined us from the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People's Centennial Conference in New York City.
And our coverage continues all week. You can find it on our website at thetakeaway.org. We're also looking for economic indicators because people are starting to say the recession is over. Economists feel that. But do you feel it? Do you work in a field that's suddenly booming? Are you starting to see orders pile up for 6 months from now but don't have any work this month?
Hi, this is Chris from Manhattan. I work for a large bank in credit card collections, so I'm kind of at the front lines of the current financial crisis, and I speak to a lot of people that are hurting. So mostly, I think I'm dealing with the lagging indicator, but for me, the leading indicator will be when the self-employed, the entrepreneurs who are suffering, will start being able to make regular payments without assistance.
Which do you do, economically speaking? Look forward or back? 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.